From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a Milwaukee researcher reports some disturbing trends in the attitudes girls and young women have about sexual violence. Then Aurora Healthcare finds an important niche for its new medical journal.
There are thousands of journals out there, medical and research journals. We couldn't find a medical research journal that had the word patient in it, which struck us rather odd.
A local author chronicles Milwaukee's punk scene in the late 70s and early 80s. And a former fashion photographer helps medical professionals and the rest of us to see past genetic and physical differences in people.
Show Billy in a swimming pool. Get the same amount of information in that photograph that you need for medical identification, but you also see the most important feature, which is humanity.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. This spring, the White House launched a website and urged college and university leaders across the country to step up their efforts to curb sexual violence on campus. The message came as several high-profile colleges saw allegations of widespread problems with sexual assault. But a Marquette University researcher says the issue is a serious one for girls much younger than college age. Heather Hlavka is the author of a report on the normalization of sexual violence among young girls. The study will appear in the June issue of the journal Gender and Society. Hlavka, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Social and Cultural Sciences, joined Mitch Teich in the studio to discuss the issues she was hoping to address in her study. And before we begin, we should note the obvious mature subject matter.
It was part of a larger study on child sexual abuse and reporting. And when I was noticing how children and youth were disclosing sexual abuse, I was also taking notice of some of the young women not really describing or identifying their experiences as sexual harassment and abuse. And this became this study on normalizing sexual violence.
And by normalizing, you're saying this is what the girls and young women experienced, they saw as not unusual.
Not unusual at all. The key here is to really say that the young women were reporting harassment. They were describing these experiences of harassment and violence, and they weren't necessarily labeling them as such. So when they were reporting these experiences to forensic interviewers in the interviews that I saw, they were describing them as acceptable, as normal, as routine acts that are happening in their schools by young boys and men.
They were saying it wasn't a big deal.
It wasn't a big deal, in that they had to kind of accept these experiences, or they felt that they had to accept these experiences.
Right, and I guess one of the issues is that they were saying it wasn't a big deal. You do make the point that some of the data might be skewed by some socioeconomic factors, that for some girls and young women, there's already a distrust of authorities in the system, which might have led them to answer questions in a way that they might not have with someone else.
Right. So they were not to say that it wasn't a big deal. What is important is to note that they did feel threatened by these experiences, and they felt fearful and knew that something was wrong. But in their interpretations of it, they were really using this cultural narratives, or what I would call really the discourse of a rape culture, to explain their experiences that they were having in these heterosexual relationships. And it could be, I mean, clearly they had a lot of mistrust of authority figures for a variety of reasons. I think that it's quite clear that some of this harassment and abuse was seen by authority figures, by people, teachers working in schools, and nothing was being done. So these young women are very smart. They know that to report these experiences or define them perhaps in sexually assaultive ways is a pretty risky endeavor. To report, they risk being disbelieved by authority figures. They risk being ostracized by their peers. And really just being shamed by their peers.
So this is a trade-off for them. They're enduring this abuse, but at the same time, they're avoiding what might be for them just as negative a consequence, which is this idea that they're not being believed or that they're being ostracized by their friends.
Absolutely. It's absolutely a trade-off.
Mm-hmm. What was the significance of the age of the people you studied? Why was it important for you to look at the issue through the lens of adolescent girls?
Yeah, the youngest I think that's what's most surprising to people is the youngest age of the young women that we're talking about here is around 10 or 11. And they're describing these experiences in ways that we've known that older women, let's say college-age women, adult women, have typically described some of their sexually abusive and harassment experiences as using these kind of traditional sexual scripts, this normalizing of male aggression as if it's natural or boys will be boys. So we've seen this in other populations, again, adults and college women, but now we're seeing it. My study really highlights that we're seeing it at very, very young ages, and we should be very concerned that this is really sowing the seeds of violence to come in their relationships.
What struck me about so many of the examples you cited is that the girls being interviewed were young, but the aggressors they described were often older and sometimes much older.
Right. We have this kind of normalization or what young women were describing as what I said was kind of everyday violence that they were experiencing. And largely this was with peers, with boys their same age on the playgrounds and buses in their schools. But then we have this other set of young women when they get a little bit older, let's say 15, 16, in some cases 14, where they were having sexual relationships with older men around 23 years old. And that's where you see this really coercive, sexually abusive behavior in which we are talking about sexual assault. We're talking about coercion and power and control dynamics happening in these relationships.
Does there also need to be parallel work done to understand how the boys are arriving at their own attitudes?
Oh, definitely. I think the study – I wanted to highlight girls' voices. In the literature and in the research, we have very little understanding of how young girls and women in general are really talking about and understanding and experiencing these type of violent behaviors. So I wanted to highlight girls' voices. But we have there's a lot to say about, of course, the young men in the study, young boys and older men who are perpetrating these assaults and taking zero responsibility for it. The responsibility is not being put on them by authority figures. It's not putting on them by these young women either.
Right. There's long been this focus on who's responsible for saying no, and customarily that's fallen to the women and girls.
Right. And that's how they're interpreting it, which is a great example. They're seeing themselves, again, within these traditional sexual scripts as the gatekeepers of sexual activity. So when they don't say no, there's this concept that if I say no, I just won't get raped. Like everything will be fine. When they don't say no, they have not adequately maneuvered around the natural sexual aggression that they see men as just doing. And so then they're blamed by their peers. They're blaming themselves and thus being disbelieved by authority figures, or at least they perceive that.
And well, and you also point out that the script for boys is kind of a how to get to yes mentality.
Definitely. So again, I talk about in the study this heterosexualized relationships, and it is heterosexualized. But what is normal within a heterosexual relationship is quite scary from this study, because we are talking about what we would call working a yes out or coercing someone, using these power and control dynamics to get a yes or to, you know, obtain sexual activity from a young girl.
The study notes that the idea of heterosexuality as the norm is part of this equation. How else does sexuality play into this issue?
I mean, I think we should be very concerned with how we are observing sexuality being discussed in the study and in the larger culture. We are really linking heterosexual activity with violence. We tend to link culturally in our rape culture sex and violence. And young women and young boys are picking this up. I mean, they're getting this, right? And so we shouldn't be too surprised that they're really adapting to this culture, quite rightfully so. And in another case, or what's also important to say is that they're looking at rape. We have this kind of narrative about rape and what rape is in our culture, and especially if in the last decade or so, that it's the stranger rape. It's the stranger coming out of the bushes, taking you off the streets, sexual intercourse, and that's all that rape is. So not surprisingly, this is not matching up with these young women's experiences at all, because rape is oftentimes, you know the person, they're close to you, they're your acquaintance. And in all of these cases, that was the case. None of these were stranger situations.
What do you see as the ramifications for this work in terms of how to address the issue? If we understand now that that for so many young women and girls, sexual violence is seen as the norm, what do you do to reverse that trend?
I think we need to start taking human sexuality seriously, and we really need to start educating our youth at very, very young ages. This is not a hysteria. This is what our young children are learning. And it's not difficult to think about educating them about sexual boundaries, about consent and respect for each other at very young ages. Kindergarten, I would even go lower, because boundaries and a bodily autonomy is the right of every child. The child has the right to protect their body and to feel safe and secure in their body. And a lot of that is boundaries, and it's just consent. And so we're not talking about teaching children about sex. We're teaching children about consent and respect.
You mentioned that what seemed to surprise you the most was just the age at which these attitudes develop. Was there anything else that, as someone who has studied this issue or issues around this for a while, that also surprised you?
Yeah, I guess I was really surprised by the use of rape as a threat. That was really upsetting to me and surprising. This using rape to get other types of sexual activity. So in numerous situations, you know, I will rape you if you don't have oral sex with me or some other sexual activity. It was
absolutely astonishing.
Which
the girls then didn't think of necessarily as rape.
Right, exactly. So it's kind of playing into, again, this construction, this cultural construction of what rape is. So if rape is only this heterosexual type of intercourse or penetration, then anything beyond lower than that standard is not rape, which is untrue.
Well, and so you said this study is part of this larger work that you're doing on childhood sexual abuse and reporting. Where do you go from here?
Well, I have had another article that's been published in Law and Social Inquiry Journal, and that one really focused on young children's experiences and about reporting and their perceptions of law enforcement in the state. So when we talk about the differences with children and, you know, racially, socioeconomically, this is where a lot of that comes out in that study, how these young children were perceiving law enforcement and how their distrust of law enforcement really acted as barriers to reporting sexual assault to authorities. Going from here, I am also really interested in boys' experiences. So my study did include half and half gender-wise, so half boys and half girls, because I was really interested in the different gender perceptions of sexual assault for young children. So going further, I want to focus more on the young men's experiences, young boys' experiences, and some of the reasons why they're not reporting. Preliminarily, that's really about homophobia and fears of homophobia, this deep shame that we know most of the perpetrators are men, so then young boys are struggling with that a lot more than young girls are. So they're not reporting because of that. And they're also not reporting if they experience sexual assault with a woman. They don't perceive that as abusive, because in our culture, we talk about how young men should always want sex, and that's what they want. So you're lucky if you get to have a sexual experience with an older woman. And in some cases, they're much older women abusing these young boys, and they are normalizing that experience. So very similar to this study.
Well, Heather Hlavka, thank you so much for sharing the details of this and the rest of your work, and best of luck going forward.
Thank you very much.
Heather Hlavka is an assistant professor in the Department of Social and Cultural Sciences at Marquette University. Her article on the normalizing of sexual violence among girls will appear in the June issue of the journal Gender and Society. Coming up next, Aurora Healthcare has started publishing a medical journal, one with a significant distinction. We'll find out what it is when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. We've had many Wisconsin researchers on this show for the contributions they've made to scientific journals. For medical researchers, that includes prestigious publications like the New England Journal of Medicine and the Journal of American Medical Association, and also specialty journals in various medical fields. One of the latest additions to the field of medical journals originates at Milwaukee-based Aurora Healthcare. The nonprofit medical group this year launched the peer-reviewed Journal of Patient-Centered Research. Randall Lambrecht is Senior Vice President of Aurora Healthcare and President of Aurora Research Institute, and he joins Lake Effect's Mitch Teich to talk about the significance of this new journal.
The most important stakeholder in healthcare is a patient, and we at Aurora Healthcare know that that everything we do is centered around the patient. In fact, it's our model. So when we grew our research and formed the Aurora Research Institute about a year ago, we wanted to make sure that people understood the reason why we do research is to improve patient outcomes and lower the cost of healthcare. So we decided to focus on a sort of a saying that was patient-centered research.
Well, and this does not diminish the need for things like basic research, right?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, basic research plays into a lot of the research that we do, and it's the buzzword now is around translational research or translational science. So whether it's at the bench level, very basic, or whether it's more applied research, clinical trials, it has an aim of improving what we know about health, disease, patients.
Does that mean that that regardless of the subject matter and regardless of the research, the call is for the authors of that research to always have, you know, the ultimate outcome vis-a-vis the patient in mind as they put the paper together?
Well, it is a little bit at Aurora Healthcare. You might find a different sort of philosophy in universities or academic medical schools. We do some discovery work, but a lot of the discovery, you know, there's when you're at the discovery level, some things are going to work out and some things aren't. We're engaged more in research that has sort of passed a lot of the efficacy and a lot of the safety, and now we're evaluating it and developing it for actual translation into patient care.
Do you have an example you might be able to share?
Let me talk about a really important trial that I think has revolutionized cardiac care, and it's the aortic valve replacement trial. Now, this was an industry-sponsored trial, but it really is about how do you replace an aortic valve without cracking open the chest. And many patients who are very sick, they can't have their chest open. So this is a little valve that's sewn in a stent and tucked in a catheter, and it's fed up through an artery that can then be deployed over the deformed or valve that the patient that no longer functions well. And the outcome is tremendous. And this was a trial that we were one of the first to have in Milwaukee at Aurora, but now it's FDA approved. And it's a great example of how you can reduce the cost and improve patient outcomes, but something we wanted to get at Aurora right away.
Why publish a journal at all?
You know, it's a great question. And a few years ago, there was an article in the British Medical Journal about and it focused on NIH research, the National Institutes of Health, and how less than half of the projects funded by NIH ever saw the light of day in a publication. And in fact, it was even worse among the National Cancer Institute, where 40%, less than 40% of funded research got published. you know, there's an ethical responsibility, I think, that we feel to communicate the kind of research that we're doing, especially if it's publicly funded. But so we felt that, you know, whether it's really game-changing research or whether it's research that maybe didn't pan out the way it was hypothesized, that research has to be communicated. And so we felt an obligation as one of the largest healthcare systems, and we do a lot of research, to create an avenue to publish that and get it out there. So some of it's awareness, some of it's community education, but some of it's just sharing with other scientists and researchers and physicians the kind of research that we do.
Well, and do you think is the patient-centered niche how it fits in among all the other medical journals, either the general ones like JAMA and the New England yeah. Journal of Medicine and also the specialty journals?
Well, you know, when we were looking at a title for our journal, we wanted to make sure that we got the patient-centered message out there. And so we looked at the names of other journals, and there are thousands of journals out there, medical and research journals. We couldn't find a medical research journal that had the word patient in it, which struck us rather odd that there wasn't one out there. So the Journal of Patient-Centered Research and Reviews, I think, captures exactly what resonates well at Aurora, but it defines sort of our mission about the kind of research that we want to put in print.
The research that's being quantified here is patient-centered, but obviously your audience is generally medical professionals?
It's researchers, it's clinicians, physicians, nurses. It is multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary, but we also want to put it in the hands of, you know, the consumer is becoming quite savvy, especially the consumer who might have a condition that they – and so we wanted to put it out there for the general patient and consumer too. But it's really geared towards scientists and researchers.
How are you soliciting work?
We do it a number of ways. We have a website. We always have in our issues instructions to authors, and we invite manuscripts from all over. So we're using electronic media. We're using print media. In fact, the journal is really it's a quarterly online journal, but we print a number of copies each quarter. I sort of come from a generation that likes to have a hard copy in front of me. But we disseminate it to libraries all over the country. And it's interesting because our inaugural issue came out about a month ago, and we've gotten emails from all over the world. In fact, one of our scientific editors was invited to speak in China. So it's not just good for Aurora, but it's good for the Milwaukee community. It lets people know that there's exciting biomedical research occurring here. But we advertise it and we invite manuscripts through all different forms.
So you invite manuscripts for work that's not it's not specifically work that's being done at Aurora.
Right. In fact, the inaugural issue, I think, had a couple articles from outside of Aurora, and the upcoming issue does too. It really does make a difference. And in fact, journals are rated by their impact factor, and their reputation is based on not just publishing work from a single organization, but from outside too.
This is a peer-reviewed journal. Is the review board just within Aurora, or do you have reviewers from outside as well?
We have reviewers from outside. So we have an editorial board. We have a scientific advisory board, and then we invite guest reviewers. That's a great question to ask because when you're starting out with a new journal, you don't have that kind of reputation. And so one of the ways to get that reputation is to network and invite folks from the outside to participate in it. And so we're hoping that in a couple of years this journal is really well known and has that kind of impact that we want it to have.
The first issue focuses specifically on melanoma. Is the plan to feature work being done in a particular area for each issue?
Yeah. You know, we were really fortunate that this first issue was the whole concept and idea couldn't have gone forward if we didn't have a really generous donation from Libby Temkin. And the Libby Temkin Memorial Fund at Aurora helped sponsor the journal. And so we wanted to really pay tribute to the Temkin family and her daughter who died of melanoma a number of years ago. And so the idea in the inaugural issue focusing on melanoma research was really a tribute to that family. The journals will have thematic approaches, so every other issue will be a theme. So The issue that's coming out is sort of open to any kind of research. The issue that comes after that will focus on cardiovascular research. So every other one will have a theme.
And the first issue is already out. When is the next issue scheduled?
Next issue, I just saw the proof of it yesterday. And so we're making a few tweaks, but it will be out probably in about 3 weeks.
Well, very good. Randy Lambrecht, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Randy Lambrecht is the president of the Aurora Research Institute and senior vice president of Aurora Healthcare. The group's peer-reviewed Journal of Patient-Centered Research and Reviews was launched this year. We turn back time in our next segment to the late 70s in Milwaukee to learn about the vibrant punk scene here. We'll talk with local musician and author Steve Nodine next when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us this morning. If you were in your teens or early 20s in Milwaukee from, say, the late 70s to early 80s, you might have heard this band, the Amidots. The singer's voice was described at the time as sounding like, quote, a witch in need of a throat lozenge, which could have also described the music a lot of punk and post-punk bands made. And if the Amidots weren't your thing, perhaps it was the Oil Tasters, or Sacred Order, or In a Hot Coma. As Steve Nodine points out, you had quite a few choices in Milwaukee at the time. Nodine was himself part of the punk and post-punk scene here, mostly in his band Dark Facade. But more recently, he's become the scene's historian, compiling the stories in The Cease Is Increase, an oral history of Milwaukee's punk and alternative music scene. Nodine tells us that even though Milwaukee was known at the time for its blues and rock bands, the punk scene here was just as strong.
There was a base of clubs that supported the music and were a place that people could come to. And I think punk was a lot of misfits, people who didn't fit in school or weren't listening to what everybody else was listening to. And they went to Zach's and they discovered themselves. They could do whatever they wanted. They could wear their hair as crazy as they wanted to, and nobody cared. And, you know, you were cool.
Well, how did it differ from rock and roll in general? Because this is what, the early 70s you're talking about, more or less?
In Milwaukee, I think this club scene came together in the late 70s,
okay,
right up till 1980 when it peaked. You know, we had support of WMSC that came out in 1980, where they would play tons of local music. If you were playing that night, you could go down and say, hey, can we come on the radio? We got a show tonight. And sure, come on in, you know. And you just had that support, some support from like the Journal, the Shepherd Express. So you had the media and these clubs, and it just formed this niche of people that got together to share all this new music.
Were some of those people coming from other genres of music, you know, like the blues bands and that sort of thing that were really popular?
Yeah, and that's why the book starts out with the scene from the late 60s, early 70s, where there's like the coffee houses and all that kind of stuff. And then some of those people that were going to that were young and ended up being part of the punk generation. People like Presley Haskell, who was in the Haskells, of course, was instrumental in getting punk bands into Zach's. And he was friends with all different people, you know, giving him ideas. And, you know, he had his mentors of people who were already in a blues band or, you know, whatever.
Rock and roll band.
Rock and roll band,
yeah,
or something. And
one of the things that I think is so great, I'm not from here, so I'm looking at all of these scenes from the outside, but Milwaukee is both big enough to support a lot of different kinds of bands, but also small enough where everybody pretty much knows each other.
That's
and
true.
The influencers are kind of, they overlap in an interesting way. And in reading your book, I could see that as you were interviewing all the different folks who are still around.
Right. What happened in the 80s was that there were all these mini genres. Everything kind of splintered off into pop, synth pop, like keyboards and drum machines and stuff like that. And bands like that would play at the same clubs where traditional punk bands like De Kreutzen or Sacred Order would play. And you had your power pop bands. That was really big. The Shivers, Color Radio. And we all played in the same places, and all the musicians were friends, and we had a cross of people that went to see all different kinds of music. They just wanted to be part of that energy, I think.
Do you think that's particularly Milwaukee, that the scene was that porous?
From what I know of, like, the L.A. scene or, like, Chicago, there was, in Chicago particularly, you know, there's like, the Effigies and Big Black and bands like that, and they played at the Exit, and they played at this and that. And, like, the Exit was, like, if you weren't hardcore,
you weren't
you didn't
go.
Want to go there.
You know? It was too scary.
Yeah. So it didn't intermingle that much. And maybe there was other places where these other types of bands played at other clubs. But I don't think they mingled like that there. And especially, like, L.A. had their hardcore punk scene. But they had other stuff going on, too. But I don't think they really mixed.
And so did that make the Milwaukee punk sound particular? And can you point to bands, you know, that were all happening at the same time, say in L.A. or London or New York and Milwaukee, and say, well, that's a Milwaukee sound because everybody was sort of feeding off each other?
Yeah, and I think that's true. And I think one of the, like, culminations of that would be, like, the Violent Femmes. The Violent Femmes were a group of people who had been around for a while playing in different bands, doing different kinds of stuff, from Victor DeLorenzo, who was part of Theater X. He really liked jazz. Brian really liked jazz. Those two got together. And the singer was a young kid who wrote all these songs while he was in high school. And he got noticed by some people in town, and they were like, oh, this guy, you got to see him. You know, he opened for somebody fairly big by himself. And next thing you know, it's Violent Femmes, and
there they went.
There they went.
Yeah.
You know.
Did the punk scene evolve in a similar way here as it did, say, in London or New York as a reaction to, like, AOR and sort of the bloated prog rock stuff that people think is being very self-indulgent stuff? Was it the same here?
I think so. And I think while it might not have been as organic as it was in, say, London, but a lot of people here were reading the magazines and knowing, you know, what was going on elsewhere by reading interviews with The Clash. I think pretty much everywhere people were getting sick of, you know, what was happening with radio towards the end of the 70s and the early 80s. And one of the beautiful things about the punk scene, and this was characterized by a lot of the stuff in Milwaukee, was anybody could be in a band. Four guys that have been playing guitars for weeks could get together.
All of weeks, yeah.
You know, get in their basement and start jamming. And if they were into it enough, they got accomplished enough that they could play songs. And they wrote songs. And
what were some of the notable punk bands from Milwaukee that people listening might go, oh, yeah, I went and saw them?
Well, there was Sacred Order. They were pretty big. De Kreutzen, who toured everywhere. They were just on the road constantly. They had a record contract with Touch and Go. They were getting airplay on college radio. They never made it big, but they certainly left their mark. And there's still been interest in them today. They just played a big concert in Europe somewhere.
Now, is there a Milwaukee-specific sound? Like, I'm thinking band makeup, like particular instruments. Did we focus on things that way, or was it pretty much all over the board?
Well, the punk bands were pretty typically bass, guitar, drums, lead singer. Mm-hmm. A lot of the power pop bands had, you know, multiple guitars, keyboardists, organs, and pop.
The famous Hammond B3
yeah,
sound.
Yeah, correct. Mm-hmm. So, and then there were bands like Dark Facade that, you know, had a Dave Wolf playing keyboards, who was kind of our own Keith Emerson kind of guy. He was in prog rock bands back in the 70s, and he was really good. And so you had people, you know, using different things. But as far as a Milwaukee sound, I guess if you weren't from here and you listen to a compilation of Milwaukee bands, you might go, oh, yeah, you know, they do have kind of a sound. But
it's hard from inside.
It's hard for me to say what that would be.
That leads me to the format of the book, too, which I find great because basically it is exactly what the title says it is, an oral history. You interviewed all of these people, both musicians and people who were around, you know, writing about it at the time or just experiencing it at the time. Did you always have that construct in mind when you were going to put the book together, or did it evolve itself?
Well, the way the idea for the book came about was through Facebook. I raised a daughter. I was working. I'm a web developer. Been in the corporate world for years, and all of a sudden Facebook came along, and I'm like, oh, look, it's Keith, so-and-so, and we all just started. And then this guy, Mike, from Sacred Order, started this page on Facebook where it was a conversation about Lest We Forget, it was called, and they had this concert, Lest We Forget. And it was about we're getting older, and a lot of us have passed away from this or that, and started this whole conversation, and it just organically grew into this. We all reconnected. So I talked to my friend Keith Bramer, who was into Kreutzen, and he had the idea of the oral history, and he pointed me to a couple books, Just Shoot Me, and we have The Neutron Bomb about the L.A. scene and about punk in general. And I read those, and while I didn't really follow their format, but I liked the idea of the oral history because it's everybody's voice. It's not just me saying, in 1982, you know, there's stories. And one of the great things I see about the book now that people have told me is you can just pick it up and flip to a page and just start reading.
And there are some wonderful photos, too. Were people donating copies of pictures?
Yeah. I knew of people who took pictures back then. And I made some contacts with Jim Prince, who I was in a band in. Called Between Walls. He was a bass player and he's a photographer in Chicago. He had a whole bunch of stuff and I didn't even know he had taken so many pictures. And he gave me just about everything he had to pick from. And Guy Hoffman from the Oil Tasters, Haskell's, gave me a bunch of photos with my permission to use.
In the course of doing the book, did you reconnect with people that you thought you'd never see again?
Oh, yes. And it also spurred a reunion show of my band Dark Facade. I think that was the same year that they did the Lest We Forget show. And that was great, getting together with everybody, although we had to plug in some players because some people couldn't make it. Lisa, our bass player, who was in the Amadots also, lives in Berlin, Germany. And the guitarist hadn't played guitar for so long that he didn't feel comfortable being on stage. So we got Jack Jurassic, who was in a band called Kafka back in the 80s, and he played guitar for us. I mean, just seeing these people again after 20 years or more was just phenomenal.
Years fell away?
Oh, yeah. And doing the interviews, too. Some of these people that I interviewed I knew well, and some I really didn't know anything about them. But talking to them, we realized we had common ground. And
do you think there's more to explore in this scene? That does this book just kind of get the ball rolling and then there's really more to do?
I think you could probably do a part two and take it into the 90s. A lot of the people who were in bands in the 80s didn't stop making music in 1990, and some of them did pretty well. And I think it could be pursued.
I was going to say, there's your next project, because to watch the evolution of what they did after they were doing this in the late 70s and early 80s would be really interesting musically, I would think.
It would be, yeah.
So yeah. Get writing.
Yeah. I'm actually writing a fictional book right now. I'm trying my hand at that. But
when you're done.
When I'm done.
Are you playing? Did this get you back into playing?
Yeah, actually it did. After the reunion show, my friend Kirk McFarland, who was in Einstein's Rice Boys and all different bands, and I got together, and he plays guitar and drums and keyboards. He's multi-talented. And we started just sitting down and writing songs, and he had some stuff that he had together already, and we're in the studio right now recording a CD.
So
which might come out this summer.
Very cool. So it's like, you know, punk take two.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Steve Nodine, it has been such a pleasure to talk to you and to read the book, The Cease is Increase, An Oral History of Milwaukee's Punk and Alternative Scene. And I look forward to part two.
Well, thank you. And thank you, Bonnie, for having me here today. I enjoyed it.
Steve Nodine is the author of The Cease is Increase, An Oral History of Milwaukee's Punk and Alternative Music Scene. We're going out with him and his band Dark Facade from an early 80s recording of their tune, Slave to Love. We'll take one last break and then we'll return with Rick Guidotti, a former fashion photographer who now helps medical professionals to see past genetic and physical differences in people. You're tuned to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Photographer Rick Guidotti has spent his career capturing beauty on film. For years, he documented high fashion and the beautiful people who wear it. Today, his camera points a lens at the beauty in all of us and reminds us that a little person or someone with albinism is just as beautiful as a fashion model. Guidotti founded the nonprofit group Positive Exposure. The arts and advocacy group uses the visual arts to help people see beyond others' genetic and physical differences. Guidotti was in Milwaukee at the invitation of the Medical College of Wisconsin's Medical Humanities Program, and he told Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce then exactly what his organization does.
We use the visual arts, photography, video, to empower individuals living with a variety of differences, but also to empower audiences as well to see. And so we do through exhibitions and through public awareness programs and lecture series. We create many opportunities for the public and also healthcare providers in training, medical students, genetic counseling students as well, to see beyond that genetic disease, to see the human being first and foremost. So through this photographic experience, we then have these beautiful images of all life-empowering and celebratory images, and then we put them on public display and public exhibition, starting at, you know, we have a show right now at the Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C. We've had shows premiere at Grand Central Station in New York City, the Berlin train station, streets of Warsaw. We have exhibitions all around the world. And these exhibitions provide an opportunity for the public to not see a disease or a diagnosis, to not stare or look away, but to see beauty in that difference eventually and then see around that difference to what we all share, which is humanity.
Tell us the story of how you went from a high fashion photographer to the founder of Positive Exposure.
As a fashion photographer, I was living in New York City and also in Milan and Paris, and it was wonderful. I was working with great clients and great models, but I was always told who was beautiful. And as an artist, I didn't see beauty just on covers of magazines. So I was always trying to kind of incorporate a different type of beauty, or beauty that I would not see just as, you know, in your basic or traditional model casting. I left my studio one afternoon and spotted a young girl with albinism, or albino was the common term, waiting for a bus at the corner of Park Avenue and 20th. And she was so beautiful, and I realized I had never met a model that looked like this. When I went to do research on this condition to find more people that looked like her and find access to this wonder, this gorgeous kid, I found horrible photographs in those medical textbooks. There were images of diseases. There were images of people, individuals living with a variety of genetic conditions up against walls in doctor's offices with black bars across their eyes, usually in their underwear. And I thought, okay, we have to change this. So I found – contacted several organizations and one particular, NOAA, which is the National Organization for Albinism and Hypopigmentation, a support group for people with this condition and their families. And I said, let's show the world the beauty of albinism. And at first, there was a lot of resistance. But then they realized that this was where we're going to partner and work together. We're going to change the way the world sees albinism. And the first person that I photographed walked in. She was absolutely gorgeous, but she walked in with her shoulders hunched, her head down, no eye contact. One word answers. This girl was teased bitterly and abused constantly because of her difference every single day. School was a horrible experience for her. And I thought, oh, how am I going to photograph this kid? She's so vulnerable. But just the day before, I had photographed Cindy Crawford on the same set in my studio. And I thought, you know, out of respect for her, I'm going to photograph her like I would anyone else. And so the fan went on, the music went on, and I picked up a mirror and I held it up to her. And I said, Christine, look at yourself. You're magnificent. And she saw it and it changed everything. And all of a sudden she just exploded with this smile that lit up all of New York City. And I realized that's how we're going to make change. That's how we're going to see the beauty in human diversity, by empowering our kids.
I would imagine, too, that merely increasing the positive imagery of people with various conditions would help itself, just the frequency of being able to see people represented in the media around us.
Absolutely. To provide an alternative to those traditional medical photographs that are currently used in medical education and in public forums, instead of showing that image of the kid up against the wall in his underwear, to show Billy in the swimming pool. So they inferred the image with a condition called Marfan syndrome. It's a connective tissue disorder. You grow very, very tall. So there's that traditional photograph of the gentleman or the young kid up against a wall, standing with his really long arms and long legs and scoliosis. Or the alternative is to show Billy in a swimming pool. You get the same amount of information in the same photo and that photograph that you need for medical identification and to see how the dysmorphic features of Marfan syndrome. But you also see the most important feature, which is humanity. So when we're changing, we're using all these images as an alternative to medical education, lecturing to medical students, giving them the opportunity to see beyond disease or diagnosis, but to what we share, humanity.
Why is that specifically important to you? Why is it important that medical students have these alternative images with which to further their medical education? I would imagine it's for them, it's the emphasis we often think should be just on the medicine. So why does it matter how it's presented to them?
Because it's for better patient relationship, patient-doctor-physician relationship, better health care, better delivery of health care. I am a fashion photographer and I can say arthrogryposis multiplex congenita, not because I studied it, but because I got to meet a bunch of kids at an arthrogryposis conference and met these gorgeous kids, and you don't forget them. So now when I go to these conferences, I bring med students with me and genetic counseling students with me, and I shove them in the daycare, and they're playing with the kids, and they're seeing these kids not in the clinical environment or in crisis. They're seeing them having fun. They're seeing them being people, being human beings, being silly and crying, but then laughing and getting hungry and just being – just living. And it's so important that we see beyond that disease. So what the most important thing for us not to see and to collect all that information that we must in any kind of a medical education is to add that humanity to it. Things stick then. When you can say arthrogryposis. You know how to spell it because you see it and you hear it from the voices and the mouths and you see it define itself in life.
I listen to you and you are so passionate about this cause. Why? What personally drew you to wanting to see the beauty of everyone?
As a fashion photographer, I mean, I became a fashion photographer not to date models, but to kind of – because it was really about the aesthetic and of beauty. And so people sometimes say, well, you know, you switched from being a fashion photographer to photographing genetic diseases. Well, I've never photographed a genetic disease. I've always photographed people. And the idea behind this is to see beauty, which is something that I'm so just – it's just incredible to me. As an artist, it's just the most inspiring word and the most inspiring visual that I could possibly think of. But what really drove me to really make that switch from shooting, being a commercial fashion photographer in New York and Europe, I was at a conference in the UK. It was an albinism conference for the Albinism Fellowship. And there was a young girl that came up, did not want to be photographed. She had albinism. And she was teased relentlessly. Even by teachers had made fun of her in certain experiences in classrooms. But she did not want to be photographed. But every time I was photographing somebody else, she'd be watching or walking by the hallway or staring. And then finally, of course, she let me take her photograph. And we had such a great time. And at the end of the shoot, she was 14 years old. At the end of the shoot, she said, finally, I can be proud of my albinism. She said, I realized, though, that the hatred and the abuse that I experience every single day will never disappear. But what has disappeared is the hatred that I felt for myself. I'm like, okay, I'm done. And that drives me every single day. And then it's the next family. It's the next story. It's the next individual who they see that reflection and they see beauty in that reflection for the first time often. And it changes everything. It drives me every day.
Has this changed your opinion of the fashion industry in terms of the images, the depiction of beauty that's kind of become standardized?
Well, I think the depiction of beauty is kind of so unattainable as it's presented by the fashion industry. But they have a product that they need to sell, and they sell that. And I don't think that we're going to try and fit all of our wonderful families and our gorgeous individuals living with a variety of differences into that standard of beauty, because it just won't work that way. We have to create a new standard of beauty, and that's what we're doing, one individual at a time.
So tell me about what you're doing here with the Medical College of Wisconsin.
Well, I get to speak to some amazing students. I can't wait to meet them this evening. But they have a whole celebration today of the humanities and medicine. And it's a kind of very much part of what positive exposure's philosophy is, that we all know there's a lot of science in medicine, but we absolutely know that there's also passion and art in medicine as well. So this is a whole day event at the Medical College, and we have an positive exposure exhibition that has been up in the gallery there. And it really is a celebration of seeing the humanity in medicine, not seeing, again, a disease or diagnosis. So we're all supporting one another in this is not a positive exposure idea. This is a human movement. It's a human movement that's happening in parallel universes. Nobody wants to be seen as a disease or diagnosis. No one wants to identify somebody as a disease or diagnosis. The humanity is so important, and I'm so excited to be part of this environment that really, in this community, that really acknowledges the importance of humanity in medicine.
So when people go to see this exhibit, what will they see in these photographs?
In the photographs, they'll see celebratory images of kids and adults living with a variety of differences, with a little bio about that person, so you really kind of have a better understanding of who they are and what life is like through their perspective. My great friend Grace is featured in the exhibition, and her story is that she has Down syndrome, and she doesn't, all of her friends want to be princesses, and she doesn't want to be princess. She wants to be the queen. They'll talk, but it really is providing an opportunity to see beyond disease or diagnosis, but to see some really amazing individuals that are out there as advocates, all based on the philosophy and everything that we do. All of our programs have to satisfy this criteria, which is self-acceptance equals self-esteem equals self-advocacy. And our motto is change how you see how you change.
Well, Rick Guidotti, thank you so much for coming in.
My honor. Thank you.
Rick Guidotti is an award-winning former fashion photographer who founded the nonprofit organization Positive Exposure. He was in town to talk at the Medical College of Wisconsin's Medical Humanities Program, and he spoke then with Stephanie Lecce. And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh Air comes your way next. Stay tuned.